I'm Brittany Harden-Tengue, a senior manager with KPMG, and I am fascinated by the practice of transfer pricing and its impact on the global market. Join me each episode as I explore the transfer pricing world with specialists who will explain the ins and outs of this niche practice where tax meets economics. There have been a number of shifts in the tax and transfer pricing landscape, but companies are still responsible for their tax planning and optimization. And what companies should be doing, what corporate taxpayers should be thinking about, and where we go from here is just an ongoing question. It's something corporations are often thinking about, but particularly now when we're being faced with a bit of uncertainty. So I'm really happy to have with me Kristen Essery, a principal based out of our New York office, who is in transfer pricing, but is also our national transfer pricing and advisory leader. So congratulations, Kristen, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks. So excited to be here today. Thanks for having me, Brittany.
I know you were on very early in the podcast history talking about Masterfile, which again is a all-encompassing, taking the full story of a company. And so I think it's really appropriate that we have you back again. And I also have Marissa Renson, who is a managing director with our Washington National International Tax Group, but speaks transfer pricing and has had quite a bit of experience working from the IRS perspective. Thank you, Marissa, for being here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Just to level set, what is the current tax and transfer pricing landscape, and how has this changed from what we used to know?
There's been a lot of changes from what we might think of as the good old days, where companies could put a lot of profits in some sandy location with a zero tax rate. In recent years, one of the big game changers on the U.S. side has been the TCJA, the act commonly known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So under the old rules, companies could just defer tax on a lot of the income that was parked offshore. And the GILTI, the Global Intangible Low Tax Income Rule, really changed that. So today, GILTI taxes everything, albeit at a lower rate, everything that's offshore. And there really is no more concept of deferral in the U.S. tax system. Moving in parallel with the TCJA changes, we also had changes on the foreign side. So again, back in the good old days, we might say companies could put profits in countries like the Cayman Islands, which had a 0% tax rate. And prompted by the base erosion and profit shifting project, BEPS 1.0 efforts, all those traditional tax havens now have substance rules that really make them impractical for a tax perspective if a company doesn't have any substance in those jurisdictions. Now, more recent years, we have the Pillar 2 rules. Those are now online or coming online in many jurisdictions around the world, which sets a new 15% minimum corporate income tax rate. When you put all these provisions together, we're now talking about 15% being the new floor. And we're no longer in that world where companies could get to zero tax in some jurisdictions.
That's a great overview. Looking specifically at transfer pricing in this space, Kristen, will you give us a little insight as to what you're seeing and how you're thinking about it?
Pillar 2 and the minimum tax rate of 15% sort of around the world now has really changed how we go about transfer pricing planning and thinking about optimization. We've got a lot of work that's been done by the OECD. We have new transfer pricing guidelines as of a few years ago. There are now a lot of transparency initiatives, especially public country-by-country reporting. And we are seeing an incredible increase in the audit activity around the globe as it relates to transfer pricing. Tax authorities are really staffing up in this area and becoming a lot more active and aggressive in auditing transfer pricing matters around the world. In this audit activity, we're seeing a lot more deep dive into DEMPI and substance. So the development, enhancement, maintenance, protection, and exploitation of intangibles and other assets. And where are those people located that are making risk control decisions? And how does that contribute to the value contribution and also control of risk? That's really become a new landscape in how tax authorities are going about audits and how taxpayers are responding to those audits. What we saw during COVID is really this work from anywhere trend where you really are hiring people in a much more global way. And that is putting a lot of pressure on some of the very centralized or jurisdiction-specific transfer pricing methods that companies have deployed historically. That's where a lot of companies are coming back to the table and we're thinking through, well, what is the business doing today? Where is the business located today? And is our transfer pricing framework really fit for purpose under the new business landscape? And I would say not just the new business landscape, but the new IP landscape. We typically think of traditional intangibles as patents, manufacturing know-how, brand names and trademark and trade names, but we're seeing the rise in a lot of new forms of IP, and it's not clear yet how tax authorities are thinking through all of it. So what does it mean to have digital IP or supply chain intangibles, or even looking at evolving business models where you've got a lot more embedded services and data that are driving value? How does that get priced through the intercompany ecosystem? It is a big challenge for companies. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention sustainability as well as leading to new forms of IP. So a lot to think about as companies kind of face forward and look at their global landscape and say, well, how do I optimize from a tax perspective?
Data is a really interesting one. As companies become more sophisticated, they're becoming more nimble with their data and able to find new ways to exploit it within their company or monetize it with third parties. There's not a lot of guidance on how you would treat a data transaction. Is it a service? Is it a license of IP? Are you selling the data? And it just provides a lot of opportunities for companies to really be thoughtful on kind of how to grow that area of their business and exploit it and monetize it, and presents a lot of really fun tax issues to work through.
I'm getting excited hearing you guys say this, because it occurred to me as you were talking that although we are in this state of flux, isn't it nice that the question still remains the same? What is the value? All of the details may have changed, but we still have to come back to the same question. Okay, what is providing value? And that is what's driving what ought to be optimized from a tax perspective, because that's where it starts, that's where it ends, no matter what else is happening in the world. So with this shift away from tax havens and this ever-evolving tax landscape, what should companies prioritize when assessing their tax structures?
Again, we're no longer in this world where there's tax havens and everyone's doing the same kind of tax planning. There's really no more one-size-fits-all tax strategy. So where we've seen the best success in tax planning is where tax is really working hand in hand with the business and where that business wants to grow. As an example, go back to data. If a company wants to take their data and find new ways to monetize it, that's the perfect opportunity to think strategically. Where do we want to have these new assets owned? How do we want to have them developed? Who should be in charge of monetizing it? Clearly, those are business questions, but if tax is at the table, then that new structure can be optimized in a way that's good for both the business and tax. So where companies get the most success is just looking for those areas of growth and new opportunities in the company and figuring out how to develop that in the most tax-efficient way.
That's absolutely right, Marissa. You said it really well. It's so important for tax to be at the table, because business today is going to look very different than business a few years from now. And we're in a period where there's been a lot of rapid transformation through products, supply chains, and value creation within those supply chains. When you really start to lay that out and then overlay that with your tax attributes and what your tax landscape looks like, there's usually areas of opportunity that pop out pretty quickly, but it does require putting all of those pieces together, because one of the things that we are seeing as we think about tax strategy is it's no longer obvious how different strategies are going to interact with one another. And so you might change one thing here, but that leads to other considerations somewhere else within that overall tax picture.
Absolutely. Yeah, just as a perfect example, I spent a lot of my work on the FDII regime, foreign derived intangible income. And so if a company provides a service to a foreign party, that often can generate FDII, but that same transaction might not produce foreign source income if the service is provided from the United States. Whereas if a company has a licensing transaction, then generally the FDII and the foreign tax credit results are aligned. So just little kind of subtle differences in a business model can produce very different results, and some might be good for one provision and bad for a different provision.
So many asterisks, you know, like this is true if in the interaction of all of these variables, sometimes these very complicated large multinationals with diverse supply chains, and depending on where transactions are being, it is a living organism in a certain perspective. So you have to keep all of that in mind. What should companies have on their radars for tax optimization as we go forward, considering the plethora of iterations that are available?
There are a couple of things where we expect the rules to be relatively consistent. One example of that is with foreign tax credits. In this world where the spread between our U.S. tax rate and foreign tax rates is relatively small, that puts a lot of pressure on efficient utilization of foreign tax credits. That seems like a very technical topic that transfer pricing may not really spend a lot of time on. But the reality is that the efficient utilization of tax credits often depends on how much foreign source income a company has. The character of a company's income, is a service income versus license versus a sale, can have a really big impact on the source of that income. So if a company has a goal of entering a new market, for example, how it does that from a tax perspective can have a really big impact on things like the foreign tax credit. Another example of a tax provision that we expect to stick around is FDII. There was some debate over the longevity of FDII for a while, but at least in the present time, it's pretty popular with both parties in the United States, and foreign authorities seem to be relatively at peace with FDII. We're seeing a lot of companies spend more time now thinking about how to optimize their FDII or develop new FDII income streams where they had not really thought about it before. The third area to watch out for, maybe it's more of the stick as opposed to the carrot of FDII, is BEAT, the base erosion and anti-abuse tax. In this environment, BEAT is probably one of the more constant things we have in our international tax code. It's highly unlikely that BEAT is going to go away. If anything, it's scheduled to become harsher starting in 2026, and there have been some tax proposals floated that would make it even harsher, and it's most likely going to stick around. And a lot of companies have been able to manage BEAT exposure to date, either because they're under the applicable taxpayer threshold or their regular tax rate is high enough, but as those changes to BEAT again, companies get bigger, B is expected to get harsher. And so for those companies where B has been maybe on their radar, but not really prompting changes, now's a really good time to start thinking about long-term and whether current models are sustainable.
I don't think it occurred to me until just right now, Marissa, that BEAT is a stick. You're getting beaten with a stick.
I don't think that was accidental.
But with that, Brittany, there's a lot to think about and a lot of different pieces of the tax code that now interact with one another. And so where I'm spending a lot of time with my clients is frankly modeling and making sure that as we think about the transfer pricing operational model and looking at, you know, Marissa, you raised the example of a company going into new markets, what are the flows that we need from a transfer pricing perspective to support that? And then looking at the characterization of those flows, is it a royalty? Is it a service? Is it a tangible goods sale? Especially if it's data, really, what is it? That character becomes very important. And working through how do those transactions layer into the tax attributes and strategy from a corporate tax perspective? Because as soon as you change or pull one lever, other things change. And so having a robust model around how all of these different pieces interact is very important. And even just doing some high level feasibility modeling, like, is this going to even make sense? Is the benefit or detriment what I expect it to be? Is really important before you kind of get all the way down the path and then look at the numbers and go, oh, that's not what I was expecting. Because a lot of times it's not what people are expecting. It's just frankly not as simple as it used to be. And so again, that modeling is really important, but making sure the transfer pricing is talking to the foreign tax credit planning and the FDII opportunities. And well, if I put this transaction in place, do I need to think about my BEAT capacity? All of those things now need to hang together.
There's just too many variables now that interact that you cannot rely on any type of recency bias. So this is the thing you really do have to understand and measure through the detailed modeling, all of the variable impacts. And if X, Y, and Z go one way, then that may change A, B, and C. And then, oh, you forgot about D in there. So the whole alphabet.
Yep.
That's right. It used to be easy. We could just, okay, tax rate A compared to tax rate B, and what's the difference? And it's just not that straightforward anymore.
We previously discussed the increased scrutiny from tax authorities. If companies are reorganizing their tax structures to be more efficient, how can they mitigate potential audit risk? Which is the whole point of this, right?
When companies are thinking about that, I would say an ounce of prevention is worth it. It's really important for the tax team to document the business changes that are driving the changes that the tax team is making. Getting a lot of questions from tax authorities around substance, and they want to know that what the tax team is doing isn't just for a tax benefit, that it is really being driven by specific factors within the business and organization to support why a change was made. And we all know businesses, people come and go. And so getting that documentation and putting it in the files up front really does wonders when that audit comes 3 or 4 or 5 years later, and now you're trying to piece together what happened and why, and having to talk to people that weren't maybe there 4 or 5 years ago. Getting those business documentation and even thinking through, okay, well, what sort of business strategy decks or KPIs that show a benefit or a cost savings or something else that is driving why the character of this transaction changed because of how we're selling our products is different. All of that information is so fundamental to telling the story of why the tax is what it is.
Just from my own experience being on the IRS side, it's very apparent that tax authorities, both in the United States and elsewhere, have limited resources, and they can't take a deep dive into every arrangement. So good documentation really goes a long way to assure a tax authority the company isn't trying to hide anything, and just encouraging them to assess an arrangement as being relatively low risk. And that's ultimately our goal.
And I would add there too, Marissa, I think that perspective is so important. The other question we're getting asked a lot from tax authorities in the course of audits these days is governance. What are your governance processes and procedures? Who is signing off on these changes or these transaction prices? What are the controls in place to make sure that your organization is doing what it needs to do to have arm's length prices implemented on a day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year basis? Also having a view of what are those governance procedures and documenting those governance procedures goes a long way to showing the tax authority we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and here's how it works for our organization. And I think it takes a lot of that mistrust off the table when you can show, hey, we are thinking about this actively, and here are the controls around how we've implemented our intercompany pricing.
And this is so powerful because, Kristen, I know you are our transfer pricing and national transfer pricing advisory leader, so you're focusing a lot on planning, but everything we're discussing reemphasizes that the entire transfer pricing lifecycle is, in fact, interconnected. You plan accordingly to make sure that your documentation and your compliance is done appropriately so that when you do get to the phase of controversy, any sort of challenge, you've become prepared for. Even though I know you're focused so much on planning, measuring twice to cut once, the point is it all feeds together. It's not a segmented phase by phase. We continue to cycle through. And if you are planning appropriately and correctly, getting your accurate modeling done, then you can document more easily and then hopefully fly through any type of audit or challenge because you've been proactive on thinking about this. I love that it ultimately comes together. And I think that's part of what we love about transfer pricing, right?
It all goes hand in hand. And as we're thinking about planning opportunities, we're thinking about that in the ecosystem, in the context of audits and the global rules around tax and transfer pricing. And even for some industries, the regulatory landscape is also a really important factor. So it all has to hang together. Maybe that's the theme of the show here. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all model, but a lot of opportunities within that ecosystem to really support the business, but be smart about it.
Well, this was great. I want to thank you both so much, and I'm looking forward to having you both back in the future. So thanks for exploring transfer pricing with me.
Thanks for joining me on this adventure in transfer pricing. See you next time.